So let's say you won the lottery, maybe $50,000, and they pay it to you in stacks of cash. What would be the first thing you do? Would you drive directly to the bank? Would you head to the plaza and start refreshing your wardrobe? Would you get out your credit card bills and pay them off? Would you start throwing the cash in the air and roll around on it on your bed? I'm Brian Ellison, and today on Central Standard, we'll talk about your attitude, why you might answer those questions the way you would, and about the scripts that play in our head and how the ways we think about money affect the choices we make, all too often to our detriment. Our Cash Money crew of financial planners brings their observations and advice. They'll take your questions and confessions and help us figure out how to shape our behaviors toward a more secure financial future. Attitudes, Behavior, and Finance today on Central Standard, after the news. The Bible tells us, in one of those often misquoted passages, the love of money is the root of all evil. That's what it says, the love of money, not money. But who really loves money? Okay, maybe you can think of someone who loves money, but I bet you can also think of someone who acts like they're afraid of it, or who is so generous or careless with their money that you wonder if they're really thinking about it at all. Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, our Cash Money crew is back. They are our regular experts full of personal financial advice, but today also they're taking a step back to look at the backdrop in our minds that all the financial advice in the world plays against, the attitudes, the expectations, the scripts that play in our heads about money, and the impact that that has on our behavior. Joining us are David Jackson. He's a financial advisor at Waddell & Reed. Welcome to you, David.
Hey, thank you.
Dan Matthews, who's a financial planner at Step & Rothwell. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
And Alex Petrovic, who is owner of Petrovic Financial Services. Welcome
to you. Good morning, Brian.
Glad to have all three of you. They're all certified financial planners. They all want to hear from you, too. So let us know your thoughts about money and your observations about what you hear today at centralstandard@kcur.org. Alex Petrovic, I wonder if you could set the stage for us here. You all professionally crunch numbers all the time. You care about dollars and cents and outcomes. Why do these vague ideas about money matter?
Well, I think money is so important in the current society that we live in. It touches every aspect of our lives, and it is also influenced so much by our emotions and rationalizations that it really is important to try to look at from on a high level of what drives us to make these financial decisions, whether they're good or bad. So it's everything that we do and we aspire to.
So, David Jackson, where do we get our ideas about money? Where do they come from?
Well, you know, most of our decisions that we make are emotionally driven, and then we support them with facts or, you know, data. And so, you know, a lot of our decisions are based on how we brought up and, you know, maybe our parents' views on money or some of the experiences that we've gone through. And so sometimes, like Alex says, you know, our decisions are not the smartest because they are emotionally driven.
Yeah, often I imagine we don't even realize that our decisions are being guided by things that we learned subconsciously a long time ago.
That's exactly right. You know, you have some people who they want to use money to just show off, you know, and some people, they're just afraid of ever going broke or being poor again. And, you know, so our decisions are based on those kind of factors.
Dan Matthews, in the work that you've done with clients, customers, how powerful are these ideas, these scripts, if you will, that play in people's heads?
They're very powerful. In fact, they can dictate a lot of decisions that people make unknowingly to them. We as planners often deal kind of in the standard finance world where we're thinking about and talking about academic finance, modern portfolio theory, or the efficient market hypotheses.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, whatever that, whether, yeah, they're just ways that we, theories that we use to manage portfolios. But oftentimes clients are thinking along this behavioral finance area where psychology and sociology and then finance are all interplaying together. So, yeah, and that's kind of what they're thinking of and what's driving their decision, whereas we're more focused on kind of the academic finances and the more the rational thinking.
Are these thoughts that people have, whether they're developed in childhood or they're passing down through the generations, how tough are they to shake? Are these things that are pretty much part of our personality and this is always how we're going to look at money issues? Or are these actually things that you can cultivate and shape and learn to change?
Well, I definitely think you can change, number one. But first off, you have to recognize from where you're sitting. You have to recognize what the scripts are in your own life. I mean, I can remember growing up and hearing they're filthy rich. Mm-hmm. And that settles into your psyche. So you have to then wonder later. I've thought later as I grew up, what does filthy rich mean?
Right. What's so filthy about being rich?
Yeah. And so I think, yes, you can change, but you have to recognize, like in any emotional issues that you might have, you have to recognize that there is that you have these issues. And then I think there's steps that you can take to correct them.
I want to make sure that our listeners know they're welcome to be part of the conversation. And we're open for confessions. If you feel like you need to talk about your own attitudes about money and the ways that has led you to less successful financial planning or bad choices, you can call us and tell us. The number is 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Maybe this will make a little more sense if we talk about some of the specifics, some examples of ways that people think about money, attitudes that they're bringing about money. Let's start with one that that I've heard about before, and I know you've all talked about, and that's money avoidance. What is a money avoider, David?
Well, it's simply put, it's the person that kind of sticks their head in the sand when it comes to their personal finances. They may be spending more than what they're bringing home, but they really don't want to pay attention to that. They understand that something may be going wrong with their finances, but they really don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, because they just don't think they're not money people. Is that it?
In a lot of cases, that's it. They don't feel like they're smart. Sometimes it's just the fact that they just don't want to know. They want to be able to live their life the way they want to. They don't want to do any kind of planning, don't want to do any kind of preparing for their future. They just want to live for right now, and they want to kind of ignore, which sometimes becomes the elephant in the room. They start living on borrowed money and, getting deep in debt and don't want to have to deal with it.
I wonder, Dan, does this sometimes take the form of people actually thinking money is bad?
Yes, it absolutely does. Let's think about the Occupy Wall Streeters, right? I mean, maybe that was a big collaborative money avoidance group there because they obviously were protesting against greed in corporate America. So, yeah, money is bad. It's often a source of fear and anxiety. And, starting with recognition of that is the first step towards getting over the money avoidance. I myself am a money avoider. And even though I'm in this profession,
really?
Yes.
This is a confession.
Yes, it is.
First confession of the day, yes, yeah. And I'll make it.
How can you work in financial planning while you're a money avoider?
Because it's interesting. I can easily talk with others about their money, but talking about my own personal finances is often hard for me to do. And it stems from, and I spoke to my parents about this before the show, I think it stems from the fact that when I was young, my parents got divorced when I was young, and I remember several arguments that they had about money. And so I always thought of whenever people talk about money that there was conflict there. And now we've worked through it, so we're good and everything's fine now. But I think going back to our first discussion here about the fact that it's deeply rooted in our childhood, that those experiences when I was growing up kind of shaped me to become a money avoider.
So, Alex, what happens if someone is a money avoider? What consequences does that end up taking for their life and for
their
finances?
Well, they're just going to end up wherever, fate takes them, and they have really no, accountability of – I mean, they have no assurance that they're going to get to wherever they're going to even want to go if they know where that is, where they want to go. So I think those are typical people, too, that see money as evil. They just don't want to deal with it. And if the Occupy Wall Street was money avoiders, I would say then Wall Street were probably money worshipers.
And we'll come to money worship here in a moment. Let's actually take a call here from Paul in Swope Park. Paul, thanks for calling Central Standard. Are you a money avoider?
No way. I'm not sure why that is, but, you know, I have a habit of not really hoarding money, but putting a lot of money in different places. And, you know, I'm 26, and it makes me wonder, what is the role money has played specifically among young people, whether it be the economy or whatever it is over the past few years, because I imagine it has changed for, you know, people under 30. I'm wondering, what's that like?
Yeah, I do wonder, gentlemen, the sort of the younger perspective on this, especially in light of the really difficult financial times we've endured here for the last 5 years or so. I mean, isn't there some good sense to avoiding money on some level, especially in light of recent history?
Well, it reinforces a lot of fears, which what we've just experienced really in the past 10 years, but more importantly here, maybe in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know, that the fear factor. And unfortunately, I think it's created, you know, inertia with people to do nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that I would want to touch on with the young people is I see it way too often. People in their 30s are afraid to invest because all they've seen, you know, in their short time as adults is kind of a bear market. And so they're setting aside money for their retirement and what have you, long-term money. And all they can think about is, I need my money to be safe. They're not thinking long-term, how can I make my money grow? They're just thinking about the worst-case scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Paul is in his 30s. I'm not sure if he's in his late 30s or not.
He's 26.
Sorry.
Paul, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so he's part of the millennial generation, and, you know, it's obviously his first, with a lot of millennials, their first experiences out of college or even after high school is trying to find a job, which hasn't been good for them. Been good for them to find jobs. So they're setting themselves on a path that's different than maybe the Generation Xers like myself, who out of college it was easy for me to find a job. But again, we've been through two bear markets, and now we're a little bit more skeptical when it comes to investing in the stock market because of what's happened over the last decade.
Yeah.
In addition, my son's in the business with me, and he's about 36, finance major, worked for Boeing. He's never seen a bull market, really. And so when we sit down thinking about how to model portfolios going forward, he's much more defensive because he's never experienced where we could actually go up without all this fear surrounding it. So
exactly.
I think younger people have been tainted, and at least maybe they'll be more cautious, but you can be overcautious as well.
Paul, before we let you go, I'm curious. You're 26, and you talk about not being someone who spends a lot of money. Do you see that as the pattern that your peers are following, or are you seeing that you're more the exception than the rule?
I just can't tell. You know, a couple of my friends, they're just shorter, young than I am, and they are so carefree. I can't blame them for that, but it's almost as if it's a bigger gamble just to avoid money as opposed to, you know, a gamble as saving my money and then, oh, it's not there one day. You know, it's a risk that I'd rather take. Maybe that money will still be there at some point in my life.
Paul, I really appreciate your call. Thanks for calling today.
Thank you, gentlemen.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR-FM and KCUR.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, our Cash Money team is trying to help us understand decisions we make about money based on the attitudes that we've adopted about money in the first place. They are David Jackson, Dan Matthews, and Alex Petrovic. We are talking with callers as well at 816-235-2888. You can also post on KCUR's Facebook page. You can even post from your Twitter account. We are at KCURCST. You know, we're talking about money avoidance, and I do wonder if you contrasted this a moment ago with another sort of attitude that people bring toward money, Alex, and that's money worship. Is that the opposite extreme from avoiding money at all?
I would say it probably is. Money worship, money status. And obviously, you know, we've identified these four areas, and there's overlaps, obviously. But certainly the money status and the money worship, you know, is a problem with a lot of people. And, you know, it's promoted in large part. You just think about on New York, Madison Avenue. I mean, they're spending the biggest bucks they can to convince us to do something that maybe is not in our best interest. So I would say money worship is certainly on the other side of that.
Well, that's a great point. You know, you mentioned Madison Avenue. You mentioned the advertising that we all are swimming in every day. Should we blame our parents for these attitudes, or should we blame some larger force in society? David?
Well, it is. Madison Avenue is good. I mean, so they convince us that we need things that maybe we don't need. And, you know, there's always the latest and greatest and newest thing out there, that the newest iPad, iPod, something that you feel like you just have to have. So these companies are good at getting us to part with our money. And, you know, there's peer pressure that comes into play with that. And, you know, a lot of it does have to come comes from our upbringing, because me as a baby boomer, I know our generation was really bad about making sure we gave our kids everything. You know, if they wanted it, we were going to make sure they had it. And sometimes our kids have grown up thinking, yeah, I'm entitled to stuff that, you know, you haven't really earned yet.
Do you find that your clients in the business worship money? Is that something that's afflicting the current typical American consumer? Dan?
Well, because everybody, you know, whether or not you're a money worshiper or your money status or money vigilant.
These are some terms that you all have for the different kinds of folks who we haven't gotten to some of those terms yet, but we will flesh them out.
So, yeah, I mean, some people, yes, are money worshipers. They hoard things. They probably have more stuff than they need. And so when you come to a point in the planning where they don't have enough, you know, money to support their lifestyle, then you have to have some serious discussions about, well, maybe it's time that you sell some of your stuff, because you're worshiping your stuff and sacrificing your lifestyle. So you need to make a change, which is often very hard for people to do.
Yeah, but isn't – I mean, hoarding – is there a fine line between hoarding and saving? I mean, that you know, obviously putting something away for a rainy day, getting a good deal so that later on you have something. Where does that cross the line to being this reflection of what you're calling money worship?
Well, here's the kind of a description of a money worshiper: is money is part of a game to them. And it's like, how much can I accumulate? When can I get the best deal possible? If I earn 30% on my money and somebody else earned 50%, I didn't do good. So they don't take building their money or building their wealth in context of what they're trying to accomplish. It's just all about a scorecard.
Let's talk to William in Midtown. William, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I was making a comment more on the lack of money knowledge. Mm-hmm. I am in my late 30s, Generation Xer, and I learned about money from my parents. My parents basically said, buy a home, go to college, find a job where you'll have a pension, and you're going to be fine. They, of course, learned from money from their parents who were a part of the Depression, and they were told to hold on to things. But now, as a Generation Xer, I realize that there is no pension. I realize that there is probably no Social Security. And so it's this sort of looming fear of working until I'm 70. I'm also a part of the generation of right-sizing and downsizing and, you know, sort of the elimination of those 30- and 40-year-olds from the workforce for younger, cheaper employees. And so I guess my comment is that I do think we learn about money a lot from our parents, and it sort of led to this money confusion when it doesn't quite jive with the realities of what's going on right now.
William, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. You know, I wonder if William doesn't sort of raise a point, Alex, that with all of the confusion and the uncertainty, that maybe there isn't something to be said for going ahead and trying to accumulate money at a rapid pace, that you know, if it went too far, you would call it money worship. But isn't there something to be said for, you know, for working awfully hard, making sacrifices to get more money because you don't know what the future holds?
Yeah, I think we had that conflict, and I think William is on the right track. Certainly he is acknowledging his past and his present. Pensions maybe are a thing of the past. So I'd give him a lot of credit for starting and thinking of just what's going on in his own life. But, you know, the conflict is between our present and our future self. And that conflict that we have all the time of, you know, what I want now for the present versus for the future. And it's hard to envision ourselves in the future because it's not there. And that's the conflict that we all have. But I think he's on the right track. At least I think he's thinking about it and identifying and acknowledging that, you know, really this retirement planning, let's say, is what we're really talking about in large part, or education planning for children, is the planning process. And that's what I think all of us buy into here, is the planning process, identifying your goals, having a process and maybe later we can talk about accountability.
Because this works with all four of these different money styles that we're going to talk about, regardless of what your type of attitude is about money. If you develop a strategy and a plan and you know what you're trying to accomplish, we can help you, you know, to make smart moves with your money.
And the plan for Gen Xers is definitely going to be different than the plan for the baby boomers and the silent generation before them.
Even when they were at the same age.
Exactly.
So what, I mean, in a nutshell, what is the plan for Gen Xers?
Well, it's taking responsibility for your saving because, for one, like William said, Social Security may or may not be there,
pensions are gone already.
Pensions are no longer being offered by most companies anymore. The government still offers pension, but so there's a different path that Gen Xers have to take. They also have to save for their kids' college education because it's a lot more expensive. So we can go into more and more of that, but basically it's definitely a different path, and they have to realize that.
Let's actually take a call about that from Jim in Kansas City, Missouri. Jim, thanks for holding on. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I had a question about education as far as, as far as my life goes. I, graduated some time back, and I'm 4 years away from paying off my student loans. And I have two daughters, and after seeing them go through the whole scholarship process, and, you know, my oldest daughter landing a number of scholarships and this and that, her having to take out some student loans that are subsidized, we still find that there's not enough money to pay for education. So I end up having to take out what they call parent plus loans. And so now I'm looking to the future of where when I was going to get done paying for my student loans, I could start saving for retirement. And that kind of gets slid off to the side again because now you've got more student loans to pay. So I'm just curious where we're going with college education. Is it even going to be affordable for people in the future?
Right. So so in light of where we've been so far with this tension between avoiding money or worshiping money, what do we do about sort of practical decisions like paying off student loans?
Well, I think number one is parents have to be very careful replacing college education or replacing retirement planning with college education. You really need to have a plan for both. And we've seen it very often where people just want to give their kids the best, maybe what they didn't have or whatever. So I would, first off, is just be careful that you don't blow up your retirement planning for the sake of your college planning. And I think Jim is identifying that dilemma that he's having right now. But it's a whole question in the country with the huge escalating costs in college and the importance of it. In some other countries, you know, they identify kids that are going to go into vocational training earlier, and they don't suggest everybody go to college. But it's a real dilemma out there.
Yeah, it's a serious friction. You get to think about it, and it's his dilemma. He's almost finished paying off his student loans, and then he's worrying about paying off his kids' loan or taking out loans for them. Well, we always tell our clients there's no loans for retirement. You know, so if all he does is focus on college costs and doesn't focus on retirement, then what does he do when he turns 65, 70, and he's out of the workforce?
No one offers a low-interest retirement
loans.
Yeah,
they're just not there. So.
Good to
well,
know.
I just
reverse
wonder.
Mortgages.
Yeah, right. They call them mortgages. Yeah.
I just wonder how much Jim is enabling his daughters to go to college, which is obviously important to him, but he's, you know, at what cost? He's sacrificing his retirement. And, you know, he may not be happy with that decision down the road. So I think maybe now's the time to consider what's more important. Should I, you know, cut the line here with the girls and start saving for my own retirement? Because, you know, it's going to be here before he knows it. And so now's the time to really make some tough decisions.
Jim, what do you think?
I don't know. I just always felt that, making sure your kids got through college is something that is so important. The benefits, the job possibilities are much greater. Your ability to earn a more substantial pay is very, very important. If I don't help them out now, you know, they're not going to have the jobs that they need in the future. I put off college myself for, 4 or 5 years completing it. Yes, I agree, because my parents couldn't afford to pay for it. So, yes, to one extent, yeah, I want to make sure I give my kids a better opportunity than I had, So at the same time, I got to make some sacrifices, I guess, in order to do that.
Thanks so much for the call, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ted in Lee's Summit, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a fundamental question about money. Why is a dime half the size of a nickel?
That's just to confuse you.
It's not to confuse. It's for the government to confuse, right?
Well, okay. That's an interesting question, Ted. We appreciate the seriousness with which you're approaching these topics. You know, we are talking about money worship and about money avoidance. These are two of the four areas that our guests today have identified. When we come back from a break, we're going to continue the conversation. We'll talk about money status and about money vigilance, two other approaches that that people bring to the table when they begin to make decisions about money. Kansas City, when you look at your own life, your own habits of saving or spending, can you see the way that you got those things from something you learned or from experiences you had? Did you inherit them from your parents? You can talk about that here on Central Standard at 816-235-2888. You can also write into us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can even post on KCUR's Facebook page. We're talking with Dan Matthews, David Jackson, and Alex Petrovic about personal finance. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Our Cash Money crew joins us today for our periodic conversation about personal finance. And today we're talking about the attitudes we bring to the table, the kitchen table or the boardroom table or the blackjack table or wherever it is we're making big decisions about spending and saving. We're talking today with David Jackson from Waddell & Reed, Alex Petrovic from Petrovic Financial Services, and Dan Matthews from Stepp & Rothwell. The number to call to join our conversation with your questions or observations, your attitudes about money, is 816-235-2888, 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's take one call before we go on. Let's talk to Paula in the Valentine neighborhood. Paula, good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. I have a question, not so much from a standpoint of worshiping money. I'm 52 and unemployed, and actually a long time unemployed at this point. And I have pretty much blown through any retirement I had saved up. So I'm actually in a lot of debt at the moment, kind of close to perhaps even losing my apartment, maybe losing my car. My question is, since I do have at least the unemployment, I'm trying to figure out, or if y'all can give some advice on how to manage exactly what it is you have to the best of your ability that you can pay your bills. Also, I guess my second part of the question is, can you recommend any courses or classes that would be helpful in learning how to, you know, like I said, keep the money you have and using it to pay your bills to the best of your ability? Are there any free classes out there that would be helpful for someone like me?
Thanks for the call, Paul. Some good basic personal finance questions there. Dan Matthews?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you about some free classes that are actually coming up. April is Money Smart Month in Kansas City. And that's a program that's put on by the Federal Reserve Bank as well as other affiliated associations. And there will be a number of free classes where you can go and get help that will help address these basic cash spending plan issues that you're dealing with, especially since you obviously are dealing with low income right now and still having to pay the bills. So Money Smart Month coming up. Look online at moneysmartmonth.com. KC.org, I believe,
yeah,
or just
KC.org,
search it. But anyway, it's a really great program, and there's a lot of opportunities to get information.
Is there great, Paula? Thanks so much for the call. Are there very basic? What's the one thing Paula should start doing this afternoon?
Oh, she has to form a budget. I mean, and it's not rocket science. You just write down what's coming in, figure out what's going out, and then you may have to make some tough decisions. The decision may mean you have to move in with somebody or accept a roommate to help you pay the bills or something like that. But it's really just 1 + 1 = 2. You know, you just have to do the math.
Yeah, what she shouldn't do is fall into financial denial at this point and keep thinking that things are going to get better down the road when they don't. And then that can set up a cycle of you know, credit card debt.
Right.
And you
know, be a money avoider, right?
It's easy for us to say, but obviously she needs to accept some sort of employment at any level. I mean, it's real easy for us to say that, and with all respect to her situation, but she needs to find something in the meantime.
Even if it's not the long-term solution.
Exactly.
It's right. Paula, thank you again for the call. Let's talk about another of these general lenses through which people tend to look at money. We talked about money avoidance in the first half of the show, folks who just sort of want to put their head in the sand, or folks who actually sort of come to think of money as somehow bad or something they should avoid dealing with. We talked also about money worship, kind of the other side of that coin, the folks who think they have to have more and more of it and should do whatever it takes to get it. Let's talk about another of those ways that people think about money. Money status. What is money status, Alex?
Yeah, somewhat similar to worship, but worship believes that money will bring them happiness, and money status believes that money is equated with their self-worth. Hmm. That if they have money, then they'll be worthy in the community or in other people's eyes and whatnot. So they don't exactly worship it to bring them happiness, but that brings them status.
Okay, now let me stop you there, and let me ask an uncomfortable question. Isn't that often true? I mean, doesn't money bring some people – don't some people assign worth
sure, on the
to
surface,
how much money someone has?
Absolutely.
So what's wrong with this then?
Well, and it's a real common problem that we see out there, that people that want to look like they have more money than they actually have. And so they live in better neighborhoods than maybe they can afford. They drive cars that are more expensive than what's really appropriate for them. They wear the really nice threads and have the really nice handbags and all the trappings of having money. But their personal finances are just upside down, you know. And so there are a lot of people that live in great neighborhoods and have no furniture because they want to be able to tell their friends, I live here, but I really can't afford to live here. Mm. And that's a problem that we see. It just creates its own vicious cycle.
It seems like there's a little irony here, because isn't this what keeps financial planners in business? People who believe that that they need to be worth more than they are. Isn't that what you help people do?
Well, not make them feel that they're worth more than they are. Hopefully what we're doing is making them know actually how much they are worth.
Right.
And then from there, they can move forward.
Yeah, but, and if they're going to actually blow up on this course later
process.
To help them identify, are they going to get to where they really need to go, whichever those important goals are, or are they just a crash waiting to happen?
So what's the consequence here of folks who have this view? Is it similar to money worship? They start running up credit card debt. They
bad financial, emotional decisions. Yes, exactly. And then it creates the problem down the road that they don't really have a plan because they're so driven by the emotional side of it. Again, to look right. And it's hard with all the pressures, and depending on what neighborhood you live in. And every neighborhood has the same issues, whether it's the so-called poor or the so-called rich or the middle class. Each of those neighborhoods have the same pressures and the same problems to deal with, just on different levels.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Wesley in North Kansas City, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, thank you. About 4 years ago, I received a large inheritance, and unfortunately, it didn't come with directions, and I really didn't know what to do with it. I really didn't do a lot of planning, and I went through the entire amount in about 2 years, even though I had a good, stable job.
Yeah. So what should he have done?
Well, that's a. Found money is a notion that we see, whether it's a bonus, an inheritance, a tax return,
It's the lottery.
Yeah. And it goes back to lottery or whatever in rare cases, but it goes back to the financial planning process. If you have a plan, if you have a process, that inheritance, that gift, that tax refund will be looked as a part of that process, as opposed to just found money, I'm entitled to do whatever I want with it, and it all goes back to what's the planning process tell you.
I'd be interested to know, Wesley, what behavior actually led to you depleting that inheritance so quickly?
If you're willing to share on the air, if it's appropriate for radio.
That's fine. I didn't have a plan in the beginning, and the money came within like 3 months. And all my brothers and sisters were busy, planning their money. Mm-hmm. And so really didn't have a plan. And the sad thing is my bank didn't even offer to bring a professional counselor to discuss with me these mm-hmm. issues.
Yeah, and I want – I mean, Wesley, thank you for being honest enough to sort of call in and talk about this. I imagine this is very common, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember an 18-year-old who inherited a big chunk of money, went through about $500,000 in less than 6 months. I mean, so talk about somebody who was on the money status trip. You know, he was using money to entertain his friends and do all kind of wild stuff to make himself look good and feel good, but really never did want to take the next step of – planning out his future and figuring out what money could do for him long term, you know. So that's definitely the idea of the money status seeker. You know?
Yeah, we had an email from Laura in Olathe. She wrote, "I inherited my money beliefs from watching my Depression era grandparents' philosophies in action versus my baby boomer parents. My grandparents bought quality things so that they last, but not until they could afford them. If you can't afford it, you go without until you can. My parents buy what they want and when they want it, and frequently they live beyond their means and carry large credit card balances." And as Laura writes here, "The latter scares the bejeebers out of me. I've always been a fierce saver in the mold of my grandparents."
Mm-hmm. Wow, that she hit it right on the head.
Didn't
wow,
she
though? That's a good email, because I have a client that whenever we do our reviews, her first question, humorously but still seriously, is, "Am I going to be a bag lady?" And she grew up in a dysfunctional household, or an alcoholic father and a mother that was a codependent. And this person is totally driven by not making those mistakes. So at least those mistakes of her family, she recognized them and was driven all the time, almost to an excess of not enjoying the fruits of her labor.
And maybe we should talk about then this final approach that some people bring to money, and that is what you call money vigilance, which sounds like a really good thing. what is it, and is it a good thing? Dan?
Yeah, it's you know, it's more of the three that we've talked about. Those are generally considered negative, but money vigilance is considered positive, but not perfect. So
what is money vigilance?
You're more frugal, discreet with your money, yet anxious or nervous about future monetary uncertainties. When I think of somebody who's money vigilant, I think of James Stowers III, just because he's the founder of American Century Investments. And he wrote a book called Yes, You Can Achieve Financial Independence. It talks about, on a daily basis, James Stowers used to eat lunch in the cafeteria at American Century. All he had was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. The man was worth millions of dollars. He could have ate anywhere he wanted. But, you know, he ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich just to show that, because he believed his values were that, you know, to be frugal and to use your resources wisely. And obviously we've seen the outcome of that, just what he's done in Kansas City with the Cancer Center and other things. But so that's just when I think of that, I think of James Stowers.
You know, we had the problem, of course, it seems to me, is not in the idea, but in the details, right? So we had Lorraine on Facebook who wrote, "If I can save even a little at the end of the month, I feel like I'm doing okay," which I imagine you all agree with. But then she says, the question is, how much is enough? And that is the hard question, right?
Takes you back to the planning process. Whether or not you do it on your own or you do it with a professional, is to identify the goals, set the budget, set the process, you know, in reality to get it going. You know, I mean, that's part of the problem. A lot of people know what some of the things they need to do, like enrolling in their 401k, except they don't do it. So they need somebody. So accountability, you know, one of the things that I think in this whole thing is accountability. And if you have a partner, it's helpful, or a coach, because it's much easier to see the flaws in your thought process if it's somebody else rather than yourself. So if you have somebody that helps you to be accountable, I think will create more success.
Yeah, and it may sound a little bit redundant, but if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. So that's why Alex keeps coming back to the planning part. You have to have an idea. Where are you trying to go? What are you trying to get to?
That's David Jackson. We're also with Alex Petrovic and Dan Matthews. They're all financial planners, and they are our Cash Money crew. We're talking today about our attitudes and behaviors with regard to personal finance. 816-235-2888 is the number to call for Central Standard here on KCUR. You all mentioned that money vigilance is the most positive of these different perspectives that we've been talking about, but you also said it's not perfect. What's the risk in being vigilant about money? It seems like making a budget and sticking to it, saving when you should, spending reasonably. Those are all good things. What could be wrong?
Sometimes you just don't allow yourself to enjoy the fruits of your labor. You know, sometimes you get you do such a good job of saving all your life, and when you have enough money where you can do some good things and enjoy your money, you still can't get out of that mode of, oh, I got to save every penny. And you live in kind of a fearful life of, oh, someday I may be broke again, so I'm not going to do anything.
Well, let's talk to Mike in Cameron, Missouri. Mike, thanks for waiting for us. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, guys. I have a lawn landscape business that I've had. This is our ninth year, and I've got two boys that have always worked for me and started out, they were wanting money. I told them to go mow a yard, and they listened to me, so I went with them to make sure they did a good job. They were 7 and 11, I think, yeah, whenever they did this. And I grew up with parents that didn't know how to manage money at all, and it's taken me a long time to figure it out, but somehow I've always taught the boys the right things to do with money, and they've been doing that. This year, they are 16 and 19, and they both want to start mutual funds. I don't know what's the best way to do that. I can go online to Vanguard Mutual Funds, and I can get it that way, or I can go through a broker, or I don't know what's the best thing to do for them. They've both got $1,000 to put in there, and they've both budgeted $50 a month to put in there.
Okay, so Mike sounds like Mike is money vigilant. He's trying to teach his children to be money vigilant. Where do you go for help with how specifically to invest that money?
Well, here are some tips. Number one, look for no-load mutual funds if possible, because those have lower operating expenses. Find funds with a strong historical track record and with a long-term tenured portfolio manager, and then understand the risk associated with each fund. But there's a lot of different outlets that Mike can choose from in order to buy the funds. But those are kind of the foundations or a few tips there to help you with the selection process.
Yeah. Is this, and I recognize you all are professional certified financial planners, but I'm asking you honestly, is this something that people should try to do on their own?
In most cases, I would say not. I mean, I know a lot of really, really smart people, but when it comes to money, when it comes to investing and making investment decisions, they're kind of like, you know, fish out of water. So I think for the average person, unless you have some basic knowledge about investing, it does pay to get some help.
Yeah. I think to begin with, I think Dan's comments are well put. After you start accumulating more money, I think it's a different game. I mean, if you was to inherit $1 million and just with no experience walk into Vanguard, I think that's you may do well, but without the experience, I would say that you may not, because the emotions dictate. But starting off, dollar cost averaging, low fee kind of funds, and I would say Mike's doing a great job of getting his kids involved. That's the first process, saving money.
Mike, congratulations on how well you're doing so far.
All righty. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Let's talk to Andre in South Kansas City. Andre, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, thanks a lot. I noticed one of the big things I'll tell you from personal experience, you probably heard this before, is really not having the money and not knowing where it went. And I can say this because it was about 2 years ago, I was working on the process of rebuilding my bike, getting some more parts, and I realized that, you know, I was like $500 short, but you know, I was thinking I didn't have the money, but actually, when I went to this thing from American Century Investments, and it's, you know, not promoting that really, but just saying that I realized that $500, I probably had that over three times, but I was just, like, doing that frivolous spending. You probably heard the stories of the disappearing 20s. And what I'm saying is that you do have to have a budget, and you have to have some leeway, but you'd be surprised how just, you know, like, a week going to Quick Trip spending $40. I'm not knocking that. It's just that really sometimes we don't have the money because we don't know where it went. And, you know, it was just an eye-awakening for me. And with that, I just wanted to make that comment.
Andre, how did you change? What finally made you stop have your money disappear?
Well, I realized that money is more of a tool. And what I'm saying is it's a means to do things. And really, I tell you, when you actually get out on your own, you have, quote-unquote, or in the real world, you'd be surprised how quick you change. I realized, too, what is it, and, you know, I realized, too, that what is the big things between really wanting and needing, because sometimes the things that you really want later on, you do have to sacrifice and put aside. And I know that life has a way of bringing unexpected emergencies, but I was just noticing for myself of all this frivolous spending. I mean, you know, I would see $100 in a week disappear and not know where it went. And when I did that budget finder thing, it really made a big difference. And it's helped me a lot more now where I can really respect the, you know, money as far as using it the right way.
Andre, it sounds like there were a lot of nodding heads around the table. You are a financial planning success story. So
good
thanks
job,
for
Andre.
Your call.
Thank you.
And, you know, Andre mentioned the budget. You've almost all, I think, mentioned budgeting and the importance of that. Can you give us the 30-second primer on how to develop a budget? What are the critical elements that a person needs to do? Is it as simple as saying, here's what I make, here's what I'm going to spend?
It is that simple. Really, it really honestly is. So first of all, you must know what's coming into the house, and then you must document and record what's going out of the house. And then find out if you have more coming in than going out, or more going out than coming in.
And what Andre was saying is really important, though. You have some things that you have to spend your money on, you know, your mortgage, your, you know, certain bills that you have to spend your money on. And then you have some other stuff that you can spend your money on.
It's discretionary.
And that discretionary is what gets most people in trouble, you know, and people eating out a lot. That's probably the biggest weakness that I find when people's budgets, and you know, they'll be thinking, okay, I'm missing $500 a month. Where'd it go? And like, well, Applebee's got it, you know.
Right. Yeah. I'm a minister. I would do premarital counseling with couples and have them develop a budget as part of that. And one of the things that happened almost with every couple is they list their income, they list their expenses, and they would show that they have, you know, $2,000 more income than expenses every month. And I'd say, so that means in the last year you've saved $24,000 then. And they say, well, no. They don't know where they don't count all their expenses is essentially what it comes down to.
I think another item that might help people, and this is, applies to a lot of different issues in life, is, you know, journaling. So when something comes up in you that you think you need the new iPad or whatever it is, if you write down what you're thinking at that time, what's driving that emotion, and so that you can develop in your own mind or on paper, what are these patterns that drive you? And then, as well as when you take that time to write things down, it also slows down the process, the impulsiveness. So then you can, you know, you slow down that piece if that's your problem. So then you can look at, say, okay, what was I thinking then? And so you can identify what's going on in the back of your mind, because we do things so quickly that we don't even know what drove that. So if we can try to you know, to write those things down, if you're having those problems where you buy stuff that you really don't need, that maybe you can identify what's driving that.
Let's talk to Joan in Grandview. Joan, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you. We were always trying to make ends meet earlier in life, and now we're there, and we've been able to sock some money into savings. But now we're at the point that we really are thinking, you know, we need to go beyond that and need to start investing that, but aren't sure how to go about it, and I don't know how to read the stocks, and I don't know the lingo, and how do I get started?
So if a person is trying to move toward money vigilance, how do they start?
Well, I would suggest, number one, finding the right help. And we are all members of the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City, and we're all certified financial planners, so you can go to our website at www.fpakc.org or letsmakeaplan.org, and you can find a Financial Planning Association member or a certified financial planner here in town that can start you with that process, helping you with that process.
And if someone is going to try to take some steps on their own, even before they get to scheduling the financial planning appointment?
There's courses at community colleges that you can look that I think, you know, some of them can be very good for kind of the one-on-one basics to get you started to understand concepts about mutual funds, annuities, dollar cost averaging, setting a budget. We're back to that budget, to that plan.
Yeah.
But boy.
But she's got the right idea, because she has done the savings first, and you build your savings first, you have that little nest egg, and then you start investing, thinking about how you can make some of your money work hard for you.
And maybe, Joan, what you could also do is just sit down and write down your goals and objectives. I mean, what is it you want to accomplish from here? Is there a certain amount of income you want to replace in retirement? Where do you want to live when you retire? And so what kind of lifestyle do you want to have? Those are the kind of things that you want to start documenting, because the more clear they are, the more attainable they are.
Joan, I hope that helps. Thanks for your call.
It does. Thank you.
You know, we talked earlier about a person experiencing an unexpected windfall, like an inheritance. Dawn has a question about something that goes the other direction. Dawn in Independence. Good morning.
Yes, I just had a comment that sometimes medical can come along and it'll take control of your finances.
Then it doesn't matter whether you're vigilant or not. You just have to pay it.
Yes. Medicare don't pay like it used to. Mm-hmm. They've really, really cut back. Now they pay an allowable amount. And then the rest of it's yours out of pocket.
So whether you are a money avoider or not, sometimes you just have a big blow to your finances. What does a person do about that?
Well, first off, as we know, that there's no guarantees about anything, and things come, and that's unexpectedly, whether it's car repairs or medical. You just have to have that nest egg. Maybe earlier in life, younger people could do long-term care insurance, or but those are the trade-offs in life. You know, your health is certainly, I think everybody would agree, is the most important. But
yeah, they say that's the biggest incidence of bankruptcy is, you know, health care costs. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's one of those things.
Yeah, we talked about the unexpected windfall, the unexpected expense. How about the completely expected future? Let's say you're planning to have a child, or we mentioned education earlier. Whether you are financially avoidant naturally or a money worshiper, what's the most important thing to do?
For children?
Yeah, planning for your children. Maybe there's a baby on the way.
Again, that goes back to the planning process. If you know, when in doubt, plan for college, and college expenses are very expensive, and there are certain vehicles you can use that give you some tax advantages and whatnot. But number one, how much do you think you're going to need? And then starting a savings program. So it doesn't matter how much you make. If you don't save anything, you know, it doesn't work.
So, Dan, you confessed that you were a financial avoidant yourself. Do you want to make a confession, David Jackson? What's your...
I choose not to.
David, you want to disclose, Alex?
I would say money avoidance is probably right as well.
Well, how about that? See, that's a whole other show here. I want to thank our guests today. David Jackson, he's a financial advisor at Waddell & Reed. Alex Petrovic, owner and founder of Petrovic Financial Services. And Dan Matthews, financial planner at Step and Rothwell. Thanks to all three of
you. Thank you, Brian.
Hey, great to be here.
That's our Cash Money crew. You can access all of their previous visits by going to the Central Standard Archives. You can download the podcasts and get other special features at kcur.org. Tomorrow, the Nazi persecution of homosexuals, and in the second segment, celebrating the legacy of literary works by African-American authors. Stay tuned now for Up to Date. Steve Kraske will host a roundup with all five candidates for mayor CEO of the Kansas City, Kansas Wyandotte Unified Government. Today we had help from Suzanne Hogan. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great President's Day.